Well, this isn't quite the last study in Ephesians, but we are getting close to the end of the book, and we have a large section to cover tonight. So if you want to open up the book, we're going to look at Ephesians 5, verses 22 through to 6, verse 9 tonight, under the theme of relationships. I'm going to read that section. Then for a little while we'll study it together. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 22. Let's hear God's word together. I'm going to start at verse 21, actually, now I see where they've cut the paragraph. Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church, his body, of which he is the Saviour. Now as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church, without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. In this same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. After all, no one ever hated his own body, but he feeds and cares for it, just as Christ does the church, for we are members of his body. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is a profound mystery, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. However, each one of you also must love his wife as he loves himself, and the wife must respect her husband. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honour your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you, and that you may enjoy long life on the earth. Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. Slaves, obey your earthly masters with respect and fear, and with sincerity of heart, just as you would obey Christ. Obey them not only to win their favour when their eye is on you, but like slaves of Christ, doing the will of God from your heart. Serve wholeheartedly, as if you were serving the Lord, not men, because you know that the Lord will reward everyone for whatever good he does, whether he is slave or free. And masters, treat your slaves in the same way. Do not threaten them, since you know that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no favouritism with him. You can have everything in the world and still be the loneliest man in it. That is the most bitter type of loneliness. Success has brought me world idolization of millions and pounds, but it has prevented me from having the one thing we all need, a loving, ongoing relationship. The words of Freddie Mercury, the former lead singer of Queen. It's World AIDS Day this week, so it's appropriate we remember him. He died tragically of AIDS some years ago. And he's right, of course, in affirming that we all long for relationships. Relationships with other people are the things that really make life worth living for most of us. Trouble is, relationships seem to be having a hard time these days. I'm not just talking about boy-girl relationships, although that may be where most of us feel the tension most acutely, but everywhere. In the family, between parents and children. In the world, between employer and employee. It seems wherever you go, we waste a huge amount of nervous energy and shed a great many tears because of relationships. Christopher Lash, writing in a book some years ago, put it like this. Our society, he says, has made lasting friendships, love affairs and marriages increasingly difficult to achieve. Social life has become more and more warlike, and personal relationships have taken on the character of combat. Some dignify the combat, offering courses in assertiveness training. Others celebrate the impermanent attachments that result with slogans like, the open marriage. But in doing so, they merely intensify the pervasive dissatisfaction with the quality of human relationships, which is at the heart of our problem. I don't know if that rings true with you. It certainly does with me. As a pastor, I suppose I spend more time dealing with relationship problems in people's lives than anything else. Why do we find it so hard to get it together? Relationships. Paul, in this passage we are looking at tonight, thinks he has the key. He believes he's identified the key virtue which is indispensable to human relationships. It doesn't matter what sort of relationship you're talking about. This virtue is common to all of them and vital to all of them. In the absence of this vital personal quality, interpersonal tension and rivalry is just bound to result, and social disintegration is bound to occur. What is that key virtue? I bet you're all thinking it's going to be love, aren't you? That's the platitudinous virtue we always think of in relational terms. All you need is love. If only we all loved one another, how much better it would be. Well, Paul does certainly mention love here. You'll see it in verse 25 and 28, the word occurs. But actually, love is not the linking theme in this passage that we're studying tonight. It's not the key virtue Paul is talking about. If you look at it carefully, I think you'll see the key virtue, the key moral lubricant to human social relationships, according to Paul, is not so much love as humility. Look at verse 21. Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Paul, I think, is implying throughout the paragraphs of this Bible study we're going to have tonight that the real reason human beings fail to get on with one another is usually pride, ego, our insistence that we have to be number one, the self-assertiveness that pushes itself forward and puts other people second, that is unwilling to submit. Nowhere, I think, is that self-assertiveness more obvious than in the political rhetoric of human rights. We hear about rights all the time, don't we? The rights of the worker, the rights of women, the rights of children, the rights of animals. Thinking about the World AIDS Day, I saw this advert. I don't know if any of you have. It's been put in a number of newspapers by a number of gay groups combining together. It talks about sex rights. I have the right to 1, sexual pleasure, 2, ask for the sex I want, 3, negotiate the sex I want, 4, talk openly about sex, 5, be open about my HIV status, 6, say no, bracket or yes, change my mind, 7, 8, I have a right to sexual health services. I have a right to all of the above, and so do you. Respect each other's rights. Claim your rights. Now, of course, there is such a thing as rights. We human beings have an intrinsic dignity, and it's perfectly proper to speak, therefore, of the need to protect people's rights by law, for instance. The interesting thing about the Bible, though, is it's not entirely comfortable with our 20th century preoccupation with claiming your rights. See, when it comes to other people's rights, the Bible is very keen that we should be as solicitous as possible. You can be as concerned as you like about other people's rights. But when it comes to your own rights, the Bible prefers us to think in terms of fulfilling our duties rather than claiming our rights, accepting our responsibilities, even if they are unassuming responsibilities, fulfilling our role, even if it's quite a servile role. Submitting ourselves to others. Even in some respects, we judge they don't really deserve it. That kind of humble, self-abasing attitude, says Paul, is appropriate for the Christian. It's something we must embrace, he says, out of reverence for Christ. What does he mean by that? Well, I think he could mean two things, and I suspect Verse 21 is actually a shorthand embracing of both arguments. I think they're both included in what he's saying. I think, first of all, Christians are to be humble-minded out of reverence for Christ, because Christ set us just such an example of humble-mindedness himself. He emptied himself of heavenly glory. He humbled himself even to death on a cross, Paul would write in another place. I did not come to be served, he said of himself, but to serve and to give my life a ransom for others. He rose to find exaltation at the Father's right hand, we're told, only because he was thus willing to abdicate all self-assertive demands for his own rights. Son of God though he was, I am meek and lowly in heart, he says. Learn of me. Take up your cross and follow me. That's the first reason we are to submit to one another out of reverence for Christ, then, because that's the kind of person Christ was. The servant king. But more than that, Christians are to be humble-minded in their social relationships, I think Paul would have us know, because we have a heavenly Lord to whom we are personally accountable. Christ is not just one who set us an example of Christian behavior, he's also the supreme authority of our lives. He is our Lord before whom we stand in awe. Arrogant pride idolatrously places self on the throne and usurps his sovereign prerogatives in our lives. Be submissive to one another out of reverence for, or you could literally translate it, out of fear of Christ, because of the great Lord he is. That too, I think, is a thought behind Paul's exhortation here. So it's a general principle of all Christian behavior, whether we're talking about the world at large or those intimate relationships of the family. We are not to be macho, aggressive, bolshy, bullying types, he says, we Christians. We are to be the kind of people who know how to meet other people halfway. We're to be known as those who do not stand on their rights, the sort of people who gladly surrender their rights, acquiescing in situations of rivalry and disagreement if necessary. Because our Master demonstrated himself such humility in his incarnation, and because as our Sovereign Lord, he commands such humility from us. We must seek to display then this submissive attitude. And says Paul, nowhere is that humility more crucial, more vitally necessary, as a distinctive Christian ethic, than when it is seen in the context of asymmetric relationships. By asymmetric relationships, I mean relationships where there is an implicit authority structure, or hierarchy of rank, or complementarity of function, where there is something you could interpret as inequality, if you thought of inequality only as people all being the same. In this section from verse 22 through to 6 verse 9, you see, Paul goes on to give three examples of such asymmetric relationships. Starting at the far end in chapter 6, verses 5 to 9, he gives the illustration of the master and the slave. Clearly an asymmetric relationship, a hierarchy of rank, an authority structure there. Then in chapter 6, verses 1 to 4, coming back a little, he gives the example of the parent-child. Once again, asymmetric. Clearly, the relationship is not one between equals in one sense of the word. There's an authority structure there. And then most controversially of all, of course, in verses 22 to the end of chapter 5, he talks about the relationship between a husband and wife. This relationship too, according to Paul, is rightly regarded as asymmetric in certain respects. Now, you may want to argue the rights and wrongs of this kind of asymmetry, but there's no disputing that in Paul's day, at least, asymmetric relationships existed, and they still do today. The issue is, how should a Christian respond in such a situation of an asymmetric relationship? Because, of course, such relationships pose two practical dangers. On the one hand, the stronger party in the authority structure, in the asymmetry, may abuse their privileged status and exploit the weaker. On the other hand, the weaker partner in the asymmetry, in the authority structure, may resent their underprivileged status and rebel against the stronger. It is not uncommon for those two responses to go hand in hand, is it? Tyranny provoking revolutionary violence, or anarchy provoking dictatorial repression. You don't even need me to catalogue examples furnished by history that illustrate the potential of such reciprocal responses that are generated by asymmetric relationships and the hostility and the disintegration in society that results. But, says Paul, Christians should be no part of that kind of vicious cycle of antisocial self-assertion where asymmetric relationships are concerned. Christians should know how to submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. That means, he says, when the Christian is the weaker party in the asymmetry, in the authority structure, they won't resent it. And when the Christian is the stronger party in the asymmetry, in the authority structure, they won't abuse it. In each case, they will rather seek to emulate their master in his humility and express their accountability to him as their Lord by behaving responsibly, humbly. This is the secret, says Paul, of getting on with people. It's the secret of having happy relationships. Now, as I say, Paul proceeds to illustrate what he means in practice with each of these three examples. And there's quite a lot of detail, as you will see, from verse 22 down to 6 verse 9, which we can't examine, I'm afraid, tonight. We just haven't got time. But maybe it will be enough if we just focus perhaps most of our time on the most controversial bit, the bit about husbands and wives, and then cast an eye as to how the same principles are worked out in regard to family relationships and working relationships in chapter 6. So look with me first at how Paul works out this submit to one another principle in regard to the wife and husband relationship in verses 22 to 24. Wives, he says, submit to your husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church, his body of which he is the Saviour. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit to their husbands in everything. Few passages have excited more comment and analysis than these in the last few years. I'm sure you're just itching to hear what I'm going to say about them, aren't you? They are immensely unpopular words, of course, because they seem so directly to fly in the face of feminist sensitivities. As a result, many have repudiated them altogether on the grounds of their sexist bias. Paul, they say, was the victim of pharisaical prejudice against women. His advice here is simply mistaken. Others, who perhaps have more respect, a higher view of Scripture, are not willing to go so far as to impeach the inspiration of the apostle in such a cavalier fashion, but they look for some alternative method of interpretation of his words nevertheless, which softens their male chauvinist implications. One common suggestion, for instance, is that the word head there in verse 23 doesn't imply rank or authority. It should rather be translated source, as one speaks of the head of a river. I have to tell you, nice as it would be to interpret it that way, I do find that wholly unconvincing. There are very few examples, in fact, of the Greek word there meaning source in a first century situation, though it did acquire that meaning several centuries later. But even if it were possible, sort of lexical alternative, to interpret the word head there as source, in the context of what Paul is talking about here, as we shall see later, the analogy he draws between the relationship of the church to Christ and the relationship of a bride to a husband, only the most tortuous logic, I think, can possibly construe that Paul is not asserting that husbands in some way exercise leadership in the marital relationship. Now, I think the only way to evade the sexist implication, if that's what you want to call it, is to say that Paul is here conceding to the prevailing culture he lived in. Hellenistic culture was one where female submission was the social norm. It wasn't quite the same in Roman culture, but it was certainly true in the Greek world. Some would want to argue, therefore, that Paul merely accepts that social norm. Doesn't mean that we should necessarily accept it. He's simply telling us how Christians in the first century should behave in the unegalitarian society in which they were placed. He's not commenting on the legitimacy of the inequality. No, undoubtedly there is a measure of truth in this point of view. Paul is not, in this passage, I think, trying to teach us about social ethics. He's advising us about social behavior. And in that sense, cultural factors do come in. And it has to be said that not all authority structures in human relationships are God-ordained. Some authority structures are man-made and cultural. Take, for instance, the slave-master relationship in chapter 6, verses 5 to 9. Paul clearly refers to that. Are we to conclude that slavery is just because the apostle commands slaves to behave in a compliant and cooperative fashion with their masters? No, I don't think we have to conclude anything of the sort. The Bible nowhere says that God created human beings to be slaves. That's not a creation ordinance. It's not the way God made us to be. There's nothing built into our humanity that demands we should fulfill a slave function in society. This is a place where slavery differs quite clearly from marriage. Marriage is a creation ordinance. It's there right from the beginning. It's the way God ordered human society from creation onwards. The question then, which as Christians we have to ask ourselves, faced with the feminist challenge, is, does marriage as God designed it possess this asymmetric structure within it? Or is that a cultural artifact? Is it some unfairness which human society has imputed into marriage, which wasn't there originally, which God didn't intend it to have? An enormous amount of ink has been spent on this question theologically, and again, we simply haven't got the time to debate it all today, not unless you want to stay here very long tonight, because I'm not beyond that, but the Chinese food beckons me as well as you. So, forgive me if on this occasion I simply tell you what my considered opinion, my considered judgment on this issue is. My own view is that according to the Bible there is an asymmetry in the marital relationship from creation. The reason I'm convinced about that is because when Paul describes the male-female role in other chapters, like 1 Corinthians chapter 11 or 1 Timothy chapter 2, he always seems to do so by reference to the creation order. He goes back to the book of Genesis to talk about it. It seems to me he quite clearly implies that he's dealing with a universal human norm here, not just a first century cultural distinctive. And that's reinforced for me in this analogy which he draws, this very startling analogy which he draws here in our passage, between Christ and the church and a husband and a wife. This is really quite unexpected, I think. When Paul says, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two become one flesh, this is a profound mystery. But I'm talking about Christ and the church. That's a very extraordinary statement. To argue that the relationship between a husband and wife is analogous to the relationship between Christ and the church. In fact, he's saying it's more than an analogy, isn't it? He uses this word mystery. Mystery in the book of Ephesians, as perhaps we've seen in previous weeks, speaks of some deep truth which has been hidden, which has been kept secret for a long while, but which now that the apostles are able to unfold the gospel has become plain, an open secret. It's not then that Paul is sort of drawing an analogy between marriage and Christ and the church by way of preacher's illustration. He's actually saying that this relationship has always been there, this mystery, this secret has always been there. Since creation, since God made man and woman, he had this parallel in mind, this mystery. Christianity doesn't change the essential nature of marriage. It has a revolutionary perspective on marriage, which has always been there, but has never previously been unfolded. That's what Paul is saying. There's a mystery in it. So Paul is arguing that this asymmetry he's talking about goes right back to the book of Genesis, when for this reason a man left his father and mother and was united to his wife and the two became one flesh. That's where what he's talking about begins, he insists. However, he's not arguing for sexual
prejudice. He's not depreciating the value of woman here. He's not excusing the kinds of sexist discrimination which have rightly infuriated feminists. He's certainly not legitimizing wife beaters. What he's saying is simply that marriage, like many other relationships, has this asymmetric character to it. It is the husband's role to be the leader in the relationship, he says. That's how it was designed to be. There's no implied inequality or depreciation of the wife in saying that. It would be childish nonsense to suggest that simply because there's an asymmetry in a relationship, because one person has one role and another person has another role, that this somehow makes them unequal or sacrifices their dignity. No, Christians should realize this if nobody else does. The church is infinitely precious to God. There's nothing in the whole universe he values more than the church. But the church's role is still one of submission to her Lord. She doesn't need to rebel against his rule in order to retain her self-respect. On the contrary, the church willingly submits to his authority. That's the very essence of her dignity. That's who the church is. And so, too, Paul seems to suggest the Christian wife should see her role as honoring her husband in that way, in the same way, he says, in which the church honors Christ. Now, I can imagine some of you are saying, oh, lucky husbands. Lucky husbands to have such a privileged position. So it's not Paul who's the male chauvinist, you're saying, Roy, it's God. Well, no wonder the Bible always uses the male pronoun for him. We always suspected God was the real male chauvinist. No, but look at the balance Paul strikes here. Look at verse 25. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. You think women get a raw deal in this passage? I don't. I think the man gets the raw deal. The unfair demands are being placed upon women. Think again. Paul's standards for Christian husbands are, if anything, far more demanding. See, he applies this spiritual mystery in an absolutely consistent way. If wives are to emulate the church in their willing submission to male leadership in the marital relationship, husbands are to emulate Christ in the self-sacrificial love they demonstrate in the marital relationship. As Christ loved the church and gave himself for her, greater love has no one than this, Jesus himself said. So Paul is certainly not giving husbands here carte blanche to browbeat and dominate their wives. Quite to the contrary, he's imposing on them a sacred duty to abdicate their own preferences, their own ambitions, their own desires for the welfare of their partner, just as Jesus abdicated all his privilege and honor to save the church. This, you see, is how the Bible contains the threat of male chauvinism. This is how the Bible handles this risk of abuse which is implicit in asymmetric relationships. Not by abandoning the asymmetry, not by some quasi-Marxist doctrine of equality, which actually never works out in practice. Not by abandoning gender distinctives, not by pretending male and female roles are identical, because they clearly are not. Now, God made male and female different. Any society which tries to blur that difference is, in the name of some misguided equality, is simply going to find it's hitting its head against a brick wall. In fact, of course, I think those of us who've sort of lived through the feminist debate can see how feminism itself has run into the sand over the years. I mean, women themselves, it seems to me, are no longer talking the way they were talking 10 or 20 years ago when it comes to feminism. They seem to have realized it's not actually in a woman's interest to emasculate the male sex. Women need their husband's masculinity as the man needs his wife's femininity. There's a complementarity of function here in male and female. And it's only when we accept that complementarity and fulfill it that the image of God is fully expressed in all its interpersonal, Trinitarian richness. You see what I mean then when I say Paul applies this principle, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ, in this context of an asymmetric relationship. Marriage, he says, is asymmetric, and I'd want to argue even in our culture today that asymmetry has to be respected because it was built in since creation. But it's not to be understood as an instrument of tyranny or male chauvinism. Husbands and wives each must demonstrate humility in the way they make that asymmetric relationship work. And that means neither resenting the weakness that it may imply, nor abusing the strength it may imply, but out of reverence for Christ, humbly submitting to one another. Let's cast an eye down to children and parents and see how Paul worked out that same principle there. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right, he says. Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. I rather like the Earl of Rochester's confession. He said, before I got married, I had 6 theories about bringing up children. Now I've got 6 children and no theories. I wish I had a pound for every distraught parent I've encountered appealing to me with that look of helpless exasperation. I don't know what I'm going to do with him or her. From infancy to adolescence, bringing up kids actually is a headache. I speak of one who is now mercifully getting near the end of that particular responsibility. But I suspect it's not until your children are at least 30 that you have any right to really comment on this subject with any authority. So let's just stick to what Paul says about it. The interesting thing, of course, is that he doesn't pontificate about the rights of the child or the rights of the parent. He speaks once again about the responsibilities which each have in this asymmetric relationship. Children, obey your parents. Parents, do not provoke or exasperate your children. So he sees the family as an interaction of mutual obligation, rather than as two rivals trying to assert their rights. Now this is a very important thing to observe, because historically, families have tended to go in one of two directions. In the ancient world, families tended to be very parent-centered. And the Roman family was very much dominated by the father. He could more or less do what he wanted with his kids. The patriarch potestas, the father's power, meant the father could kill his child if he wanted to, or sell him into slavery. All the rights belong to the parent, and all the duties belong to the child. And I suppose you could argue that same attitude prevailed through much of European history, up to the Victorian era, perhaps. It's in our 20th century that the tables have rather turned, hasn't it? Now we seem to see much more the child-centered family. It's the child that everything revolves around, and the parent who often feels like the victim. I came across an interesting little piece written by Gillian Reynolds in the Daily Telegraph some years ago, a very frank article entitled Nightmare of Guilt. Let me read you a little bit of it. If being in love means never having to say you're sorry, being a mother means always being in the wrong. When the baby cries, it's your fault. When the toddler pours packets of cornflakes down the lavatory, that's your fault too. When the moody adolescent cultivates a hairstyle with dyed bits and retreats behind a bedroom door to the throbbing strains of Frank Zappa, you know you're really to blame. It doesn't need your mother or your husband to tell you so. It certainly doesn't require the towering rage and the quivering indictment of the aforementioned teenager. You know it already. If only you had done everything differently, given them better training, nicer books to read, been stricter or less strict, none of this would have happened. The only consolation is that exactly the same thing happens to every other mother. No matter what you do, it's bound to be the opposite of what you should have done. Now, I suspect there are a lot of mothers who can sympathize with that. Parents these days do get blamed. Interesting, though, isn't it? That Gillian Reynolds should feel it is the mother who gets the blame. And we do tend to think of parenting as a mother's duty, don't we? In that connection, it is worth just noting that Paul puts the onus here on fathers. Do you notice that? Fathers, he says, do not exasperate your children. Now, we mustn't overstress that. See, Paul, unlike a modern writer, doesn't have a publisher with a censor's pencil quivering at the ready, anxious to eliminate every possible non-inclusivist piece of language that he might be misguided enough to include in his writing. So Paul is able, together with 99.9% of the population of the world over the course of history, to use male words to embrace male and female together when he wants to, without being accused of sexism in the process. Almost certainly, when he says fathers here, you could rightly understand him to mean parents. He certainly includes father and mother in his quotation from the law in verse 2. Honor your father and mother, he says. So if you wanted to render verse 4, as many translations do, parents, do not exasperate your children, you'd be perfectly right to do so, I think. But the fact that he does actually use the word father is not insignificant. Because, of course, it's all, again, part of this asymmetry within the marital relationship of which he's just been speaking. It is the husband's role to be the leader in the family, and therefore he must take the predominant responsibility for the discipline and the instruction of the children in the family, not the mother at all. That would be Paul's natural assumption. In that respect, of course, I guess many a mother would be grateful for Paul's words here. All too easily these days, fathers abdicate their role, don't they, as parents, leaving it to the mother. And that's one of the ways, of course, in which fathers exasperate their children, neglecting them. They don't have to physically abuse them to exasperate them, just not being there for them. Some of you, I guess, who are kids grown up in the homes of very busy fathers, or maybe from single-parent families, know the pain and the difficulty of not having dad around. Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and the instruction of the Lord, he says. Parents have a responsibility. They don't have the right to domineer their children in a way that makes their children angry and upset. Rather humbly, they have a role to fulfill under the Lord's authority to bring their children up in the training and the instruction of the Lord. But equally, Paul doesn't let the children off the hook, does he? He doesn't say children have no responsibility in creating a happy family environment. No, he says, you too have a certain role and duty to fulfill. You can't just be a taker in this family relationship. You've got to obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. And he points out that there's a certain promise associated with that. That it may go well with you and that you may enjoy long life on the earth. Now, what does he mean by that? Does he mean that individually? That if we only obey our parents, we are personally going to have a happier life? Well, he might mean that. He might well mean that. For, of course, the fact is, if you don't learn to respect authority structures in the home, you're going to have a hard time when you leave home. We perhaps live in the dream world in adolescence, that it is only at home that authority structures handicap us, or maybe at school, that once we're out of school and out of home, we will be free. It's not true, of course, is it? All you find when you actually get out in the big bad world is there are an awful lot of other authority structures around. Masses of other people want to tell you what to do. From traffic wardens to policemen to governments to taxmen to matrons in the hospital and bosses at work. The world is full of asymmetric relationships, full of authority structures. And if we don't learn how to happily, humbly cooperate with those asymmetries, then we're going to have a very unhappy life. But it may also be, I think, because Paul is quoting from the law here, that he doesn't just mean individually we shall have a happier and more contented life if we learn how to obey our parents when we're young. He may mean that society as a whole actually is happier and more coherent. For, of course, dysfunctional families breed juvenile delinquency. The statistics of that linkage has been proven again and again and again. If we don't have families collaborating in this way, children learning how to accept authority, recognizing that authority is not to be resented, but is actually for their good, and that actually they're happier and the world is happier and that things get done when there's respect
for these asymmetric relationships and authority structures. If children don't learn that, if they grow up rebellious and surly and angry, why then crime rates grow? And of course they're unable to form good marriages, so marriage breakup rates grow. And always around, good citizenship goes down the drain. The family is such an important institution from that point of view, isn't it? Like a little microcosm. It's where we learn our social skills. One of the reasons many people have difficulty with relationships is because those social skills weren't adequately learnt right there. And that's why perhaps some of us need to come and learn them again from the Apostle Paul. Well, we could go on and talk about slaves and masters. I suppose, if anywhere, Paul is being politically incorrect. This is the place, isn't it, when he says, slaves, obey your earthly masters. One recalls Abraham Lincoln's famous comment, whenever I hear someone arguing for slavery, I feel a strong desire to see it tried on him personally. Isn't Paul at least tacitly arguing for slavery here? He's certainly giving no hint of any fundamental moral objection to the institution. But as we said earlier, that would be a mistake. Paul is here offering advice to Christians about social behaviour. He's not implying that slavery is a creation ordinance in the same way that marriage is, just because he puts one up against the other here. The fact is slavery was an institution in the ancient world. What is perhaps a little unexpected is that he advises Christians to show the same kind of humble-minded attitude to these man-made asymmetries as we demonstrate to the ones which are God-ordained and built into us by creation, like marriage and family life. Authority structures, he seems to suggest, are to be respected, even when the institution, like the institution of slavery, is an institution we might have moral objection to or feel we have no necessary right to endorse. Instead of becoming a sort of Marxist rebel trying to machine gun the master, says Paul, the right way for masters and slaves who are Christians to sort this thing out is submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. That means if you're a Christian slave, you have the humility to treat your master with respect, seeing even in that authority relationship between master and slave a kind of echo of the authority relationship between you and the Lord, who you really serve. And if you're a Christian master, you are to have the humility to treat your slave similarly, with respect, not bullying him or her. Again, out of reverence for Christ. Just as in the case of the husband and wife and the parent-child, there's an asymmetric relationship here, and the Christian response to all such relationships is not to resent the authority it represents, or to abuse the authority it represents, but rather out of reverence for Christ, to draw the sting of any potential rivalry or animosity it might create through humility. Instead of smoldering indignation or sullen insolence, slaves serve wholeheartedly, he says. Instead of patronizing contempt or physical intimidation, masters, treat your slaves with respect. This is a principle, he says, a principle of mutual service, mutual submission, and it applies to all human relationships where Christians are involved. The uncongenial and the unjust relationships, he says, no less than the God-ordained and the necessary relationships. This is the way we Christians change the world. Not by being bolshy. We change the world the same way our master changed the world, by accepting the role of servant. Yes, even if necessary, an abused and a suffering servant. When Peter gives his advice to slaves, echoing Paul here, he puts it like this. To this you were called, he says. For Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example you should follow in his steps. You have a vocation, he says, to demonstrate to the world this humble, submissive, servant attitude. I don't know, but I can't help thinking if Freddie Mercury had understood this, maybe he would have found that relationship
he so much longed for. Maybe he wouldn't have gone to his grave, such an embittered and cynical young man. Oh, let's pray together.